You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, March 27th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It's Casual Friday, folks, but nothing casual about this Friday. Cliff Schechter's on vacation. So joining me with my good friend, the Rolling Stone contributor and author, best-selling author, Guy Lawson will be joining us for movie reviews, probably Matt and Michael. Couldn't get anybody else.
Probably Matt and Michael.
What are you going
to
do?
Why do you have to sound so Morning Zoo?
Yeah, it's a little bit
like depressed Morning Zoo.
Yeah. Sad Morning Zoo. Also on the program today, Senator Harry Reid, minority leader in the Senate, announces that he will not seek re-election in 2016. Also on the program today, and that may have, I mean, it's already starting to look like there may be implications for this doc fix coming out of Congress, which passed yesterday, the House, I should say. Also, last night in the Senate, only symbolic, but important in terms of getting them on the record, every Democrat in the Senate voted to expand Social Security. Yes. Meanwhile, in Iraq, Iranian forces and Shiite militias opt out of the Tikrit battle that now involves U.S. air power. You're lucky I don't have the Bush was right keyed up. And Scott, Governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, back on his immigration stance. No. Scott walking back his stance on immigration.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm just getting ready for the clown car.
Mm.
We're going to be doing, I think on Tuesday, we're going to go through all the most recent stuff on the clown car. Cruz, Paul. There was the Senate last night was just a free-for-all.
It will make 2012 almost look dignified.
Indeed. Also on the program today, I don't know that he's going to run, but Mike Pence, potential 2016 candidate, signs into law a bill that says it's okay to discriminate against gay people if you pretend you're doing it for religious reasons or if your religion is just bigoted, I guess. And Louis Gohmert says he's going to run for president and then quickly says he's not going to run for president.
Slack!
Yeah, exactly. Wow. Wow. Harry Reid just backed Schumer to replace him as Senate Democratic leader. Wow. Wow. That's pretty crazy. All right. We will dig into all of that on the program today. Just to give you a sense of what's going on with Harry Reid. Harry Reid's poll numbers in Nevada, not great. Now, you recall that he eked out the election in 2010. A lot of people thought he was going to lose that one. And according to people who report well on this stuff, Dave Weigel being one of them, that in many respects there's a feeling that the Democrats on a on-year election, that being a presidential election, are most likely to win in Nevada. And a lot of people think that it'll be easier for them to actually defend an open seat than one with Reid. So Reid decides to step down in a presidential election, which is far more helpful than, say, like a Tom Harkin, who says, I got to get out of here on an off-year election, and the Democrats lose that seat. So Harry Reid stepping down, and then the question would be, who becomes the minority leader? And it appears with this report that he is backing Schumer, that it's probably going to be Schumer. I'm not terribly excited about that. It was either going to be between Durbin or Schumer, and my guess is if Harry Reid is coming out for Schumer, that's been something that's already been discussed, that the three of them got into a room and figured it out. That's just my guess. I got to say just a word or two, and it's not because of that photo that is now on my Twitter feed of Harry Reid punching me in the face at Yearly Co's in 2006, that and I've known people who've worked for Harry Reid in the past. My sense is that Harry Reid very underestimated by in general as a politician and on the left as to what he has, what things he stopped and what things he has pushed. I suspect that we would have seen a lot more attempts by President Obama and maybe even successful ones to make deals with the Republicans that we would not have liked were it not for Harry Reid. And I think maybe we got to wait for someone to write a book about that. All right, let's take a quick break. Like I say, usually what we do is Cliff Schechter will be with us to look back on the weekend news. We won't be doing that as much with Guy. He's got a great story that's coming out in Rolling Stone about these Oxy dealers in Florida and also what it says about Big Pharma and the lack of regulation that existed in Florida. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, ladies and gentlemen. It's always a pleasure to welcome to this program contributing a writer to Rolling Stone magazine, author of, well, I guess his latest book is coming out in a moment, shortly, of now three books, including Octopus, Sam Israel, The Secret Market, and Wall Street's Wildest Con. Looking forward to The Arms and the Dudes, ladies and gentlemen, Guy Lawson.
Hey, Sam.
After all that, Guy, that's all you have, just hey?
Well, thank you for that warm introduction. It's always a pleasure to be on the Majority Report. Lord knows it's the only place I find my Facebook likes. And what would a conversation be without our Facebook like part?
I know. That's basically what it's that's what it's all come down to now. We're just constantly marketing ourselves.
Right, man. I was at a thing this weekend at Woodstock, the Writers Festival, and they were talking about social media and journalism. And it's my view, you know, that anything with the word twit in it is probably not a good long-term plan for a culture.
Well,
so, you
come
know,
on.
Twitter. Hey, I know. You live on Twitter, don't you?
I spend all my time on Twitter.
Yeah. I don't know. I said Facebook was the pet rock of our generation. I don't think I've been quite right about that one.
You sort of missed that one, I think. all right, let's start with, now, wait a second. Now you're going out to California. Is that right?
I'm getting on an airplane tomorrow. I'll be in LA for the week. We're going to visit the set of the movie Arms and the Dudes, which is being shot, even as we speak.
That's pretty exciting.
Yeah. We got the stars are Jonah Hill and Miles Teller, of Divergent fame. My daughters, Lucy and Anna, claim they're going to take selfies with them. My 11-year-old twin girls, I think they're going to panic and freeze up, but we'll see. And the director is Todd Phillips of The Hangover. And, you know, apparently it's all got a good vibe and going well. But, you know, as the writer of the underlying material, it's not like I'm going to be a VIP on the set. I'm sure I'll just be sitting there watching it.
Well, like I suggested to you, this is what I think you should do when you first get on the set.
Uh-huh.
And as soon as they start to roll, you give it like 25 seconds, and then you just yell, cut.
I thought maybe I'd borrow your cop uniform from your recent performance.
Oh, I don't know if I actually – I don't know if I tweeted that out. It's a little
awesome
bit of a
photo.
Spoiler alert in the Marin show. I end up in a cop outfit at one point. So
you missed your calling. I swear to your listeners, I don't think I've ever seen Sam look quite as happy as he looked in that cop uniform in a photo. You looked ecstatic.
Like, don't I look like I'm about to go out and basically basically, you know, to take someone's civil liberties away?
Tase someone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually doing a story for the New York Times Magazine about, to turn from like the comic to the serious, about a Native American kid who was shot and killed by the police in Oklahoma in Custer County. Imagine being a Native American and living in Custer County.
Nice.
But the thing of it is that, yeah, that uniform and that kind of sense of power, I mean, I'm really not joking about with you. It's a very serious story. A lot of this stuff that's been in the press for folks that have been following the police violence story and the race narrative, a really significant piece of it is to do with mental health and to do with people with bipolar, schizophrenic, suffering from mental breakdown. And that is a lot of what the killing has been about and it has long been about. And it's finally coming to the fore, and my story will be focusing on that.
And of the victims.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, police get called to the home of a lot of times they're younger people. A lot of the more severe cases of schizophrenia come on in late teens, early 20s. Maybe they've been abusing substances. They're off their meds. Police get called. Oftentimes they're brandishing some sort of screwdriver. That was a case in Dallas last week. You know, alleged knife or, you know, there's some sort of element of threat to the police and they start screaming. They escalate the confrontation and then they wind up shooting these people. So, you know, the tragedy of it is that what begins as an intervention to try to help someone just rapidly and almost sometimes instantly, descends into this killing the person who they're supposed to be helping.
But do do you think in general that's the case? I mean, you know, in following a lot of these cases, and I know that the DOJ report supposedly exonerated Wilson in Ferguson, but the other report basically said, "Hey, there's systemic racism throughout this and corruption throughout this entire police force and beyond." And the a couple of the guys who were singled out in that for sending racist emails were sort of the first guys on the scene. So all of the sort of a lot of the facts that we presume as facts around Wilson are a function of these guys who appear to have sort of, you know, operate. Racism seems to be one of their operating principles.
I think there's like three or four different factors here, and I think that they often come together. One of them is, of course, race. You know, in the story I'm writing about is Custer County, Oklahoma, right?
Right.
So I'll just take that as understood. But there are other elements to it, I think. You know, another one is mental health, and that is a huge issue. In fact, there was it could be as big as, you know, like it could be as big a civil rights decision. It won't be, but it could be, as has been had in many years. A Supreme Court case was argued on Monday in a case called Sheehan versus the city of San Francisco. And basically what happened in that case is that there was a woman in her 50s who was living in a home for mentally disturbed people, went off her meds, refused to take her meds. And so the head of this facility emptied the place out and called the police and said, "We need to have an intervention," specifically saying it's for mental health reasons. PD is supposed to send people who've been trained in dealing with mental health issues, how to, you know, there's all these protocols to not escalate, to use time, all these different things that you're supposed to do with someone who's having an episode. These two cops turned up, and it just went, like, completely the wrong way. They kicked down the door. They caused a confrontation. This woman was brandishing I think it was a knife, maybe it was a screwdriver. In any event, they shot her, like, six times, you know? And so in a matter of 10 seconds, it goes from somebody, the police trying to intervene to help somebody, to shooting them. And the case has reached the Supreme Court. And the question is, what duty do the police have in that situation to someone with a mental disability? And it was amazing to listen to read the transcript of the argument, as I did yesterday. You've got Justice Scalia essentially saying the police owe nothing to anybody in any circumstance and that the law doesn't apply to them. You've got, from that sort of extreme view of law enforcement as like a law unto itself, you know, Sotomayor and many of the other justices were looking at, you know, what is it? When do police have a responsibility to de-escalate and to remove themselves from and not create confrontation? So I think that's a big piece of it. And then another piece of it I think is huge, Sam, is just police culture. And, you know, the idea that you always get to order people around, and if they're not compliant, you escalate. And that to me is another huge piece of it. So I agree that race is a big thing. It's something I've been really thinking about a lot lately, actually. And I feel like it's an important story that is more complicated than has been, you know, portrayed in the press.
That's fascinating. And that's going to come out, and that's going to be in the Times, what, in a couple of weeks?
No, I'm going out to Oklahoma to report it right after the L.A. trip. So it'll probably be more like sometime in June or something.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this piece that I know is coming out soon in Rolling Stone, because
next issue.
You know, sort of like the dudes and the arms dealers, and folks have not heard the story behind that. We've spoken about that story, I think, a couple of times.
Yeah,
and it's the story grew. You know, there's the sort of the melodrama of two 18-year-olds essentially becoming the largest small arms dealers in the history of the United States.
Of the universe. Let's say universe.
And then there's the whole other story that I think as you expand in the book about the U.S. government really just using these guys or being aware of that supposedly they were getting – just being aware of what they were doing.
What you have is you have like this, you know, so the United States government decides to torture, right? And so whose fault is that? That's Lindy English. It's not George Bush's or Donald Rumsfeld's.
Right.
The United States government decides to spy domestically and soak up all your emails, all your phone calls, everything that is you would assume to be private. And, of course, that's all Ed Snowden's fault. Then in Iraq, they start to kill civilians. The United States military starts to kill civilians, and that's all Chelsea Manning's fault, right? Like, there's a pattern here. Like, these young, defenseless, essentially fall guys or scapegoats are supposed to personify these massive changes in policy. And that was true for the arms dealing story. You know, essentially the United States government, after it invaded Iraq and Afghanistan, realized that it needed to create armies. And in order to do that, they needed to get a whole ton of weapons into these places to stand up these armies in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in order to do that, they needed to buy a whole boatload of this stuff from the former Soviet countries, which is essentially the Balkans, because they'd banned the Chinese and the Russian in a crazy sort of fit of pique. Anyway, the point is that they couldn't go do it themselves. They couldn't send jarheads into Albania to buy these weapons. They needed private contractors, because private contractors give you this beautiful thing called plausible deniability, right? It gives you a scrim. You're not the one paying the bribes. You're not the one, you know, dealing with gun runners and people who are known to be selling arms to African warlords. You've got these private contractors, and that's what the kids were. They were like online gamblers, but they were gambling with, you know, arms contracts. So that was that story, and they became the scapegoats, of course, front page of the New York Times. Like, whose fault is it? It's two kids. And nobody stopping to say, well, hey, man, what about the emperor? What's the emperor wearing here? Did the Pentagon really not know what was going on here? Did the Pentagon really have no clue what it was getting? And then, of course, you know, Sam, as you read the book, you'll see that what the net result of this is, and this is whenever I say this to somebody who's experienced with the federal government, they just laugh, because this just so makes perfect sense, is the United States government set out to break the law, and then the United States government's law enforcement agency set out to stop it from breaking the law. And the result was they screwed up the policy, which is they stopped getting the weapons to the Afghans.
Right.
You know? So you wind up with basically a cluster. You know the word.
Yeah, no, I definitely know the word.
And it winds up with the kids in prison. You know, like that solves everything. Woo!
And we should say, too, you know, part of that story is also sort of the, and I know, you know, sort of, I guess, part of the backstory there is also the failure of that story to be reported,
yeah.
Which is, you know, I mean, like you say, the Times were on it, and that part of the story was not reported. We're going to see it in your book, but
yeah.
That's a pretty, I mean, you know, that's sort of what we all sort of expect the Times to do right, right? I mean,
I'm writing for the Times, and I think it's an incredibly important and powerful instrument in our society. But, you know, it's also, you know, a part of the establishment, and it doesn't get held to account. You know, how often do you see people able to talk back to the New York Times? And that was maybe the best fun of writing the book, was being able to quote these kids pointing out exactly the ways the New York Times got the story wrong.
Right.
I mean, how often do you get to do that?
Not
that much. I mean,
yes, that's true. Particularly in terms of reporting. Well, all right. So let's talk about this story that you have. I don't know what it's going to be titled, but it's about
the Dukes of Oxy, I think.
So these guys, all right, tell us the story, because this has that also that same element too, where
It does, yeah.
An
totally.
Environment is created where these guys could actually do what they're doing. And the story that's going to get told primarily is the story about these guys, right? I mean,
right.
I imagine.
But the bigger story by far is the corporate one, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what that's what struck me about it. Although it's also an amazing sort of, I don't know, Goodfellas-ish type of story.
Right.
So tell us about Dodd and
basically
the little general.
Right. You have these kids. How the story comes to me is maybe interesting, just to frame it up a little bit, is that prisoners pitch me stories from time to time, you know, kind of regularly, and some prisoners sort of become like these jailhouse writers and pitch me stories about other prisoners. So the way it came to me was one of these jailhouse writers hooked up with one of these kids who was in prison doing time for the story I'll describe in a second. And so I read the manuscript. They'd written this thing, and, you know, I don't have any, you know, it wasn't the easiest read, you know, but it contained like a kernel of something interesting. And so I began to communicate with the main guy, is this guy, Doug Dodd. And essentially this is the story. He's like a kid in Hudson, Florida, which is like a redneck suburb, exurb of Tampa. He's on the wrestling team. You know, his parents are divorced. They live in trailers. He's, you know, they're driving around in sort of pickup trucks and smoking dope. And he's a little bit of, he's a dope dealer in high school and a sort of a muscle-bound, short wrestler guy. And he gets caught smoking weed on the way home one day from school or from work and gets put on probation. And part of the probation means you have to go home after school. And that he gets bored. And he's got this cousin who's depressed or whatever. And this cousin says, hey, try this. And he gives him a roxycodone, which is a kind of painkiller that if you crush it up and snort it, becomes what they call hillbilly heroin, right? This is the Oxy and Roxy plague of America. Essentially, it's a pain, a severe pain medication invented 100 years ago to treat people in war that has been repurposed by the United States pharmaceutical industry into this multi-billion dollar pain pill industry. So the kid, you know, he starts to snort it every day and starts to share it with his friends because in Florida, this drug is ubiquitous. And here's why. And here's where the sort of what you talked about, the corporate kind of element of it is. Florida, in the state, I just want your listeners to sit down for a second and listen to this because this is a true fact. This is one of the most amazing facts I've ever come across in all my reporting life. The state of Florida in 2008 issued 10 times more pain pill medication prescriptions than the rest of the United States combined. 10 times more than the rest of the United States combined. So say the rest of the United States issued $100 million pills, pain pills for various maladies and surgical procedure, post-surgical procedures. That would be like Florida did a billion alone. It's just the mind boggles. So
now wait a second. Now, to a certain extent, one would anticipate that Florida would probably, on a per capita basis, have more because older people, right?
Yeah, 10 times more than all of the rest of the United States combined.
Right. So, in other words, there's not more people over the age of 55 playing golf and want to sort of loosen up in Florida than the entire rest of the country.
Well, so, you know, the economics of it, it's a little like the arms dealing thing in a simple sense. Like, so the government in the arms thing essentially said, get us the cheapest ammo you can. So what do you wind up with? Cheap ammo. In this case, the Florida state government refused to have any registry of to track the number of prescriptions patients had, supposedly on the basis of privacy, right?
Right, because it's un-American for the government to get involved in that type of thing.
To know how many prescriptions you have. But, of course, that just meant that people would get dozens of prescriptions, and they'd start selling their pills. So you have all these pillbillies, they call them, you know, along the redneck Riviera, taking this hillbilly heroin and then monetizing it. So what it created was a marketplace in Florida where the street value of an oxycodone pill was like $8, and in the rest of the country it was 50, right? And so this 18-year-old kid and his buddies are sitting there one day at the beach getting wasted on these pills. And one of their brothers says, hey, man, you know, these things go for $50 up in Tennessee. And the kids go, really? No shit. Excuse my language. And the next thing you know, they ship up 500 pills to see what happens. They sell out in one day. They ship 1,000. They sell out in one day. And all of a sudden, they're shipping thousands of pills, 20,000 pills a month, up from Florida, where it's essentially legal, meaning to say that trading in these drugs is so ubiquitous, And the supply is so huge into Tennessee, so they're feeding basically college kids and wrestling teams up in Tennessee these pain pills, and they're making millions of dollars, and they're 18 years old.
Wow, it's sort of like if you wanted to remake Smokey and the Bandit, I guess that's what it would be, right?
Because that's the Dixie Boxy, where
they brought the cigarettes like from one place that had low taxes to another or something.
Yeah. It's an arbitrage. The funny thing was that the kids had the realization. They were sitting in their community college business 101 class, and they're like, "Do you realize what we could do?"
Well, that's the amazing thing about the story. You have one kid who's sort of out of control, and then the other one who's like, I'm just going to get a small stake here. And
the little general, I just got an email from him this morning. He's doing 15 years. You know, so what happens, of course, is the kids get addicted to the drug, right? And they get addicted to the money and the girls and the fast life and the pickup trucks, the late model, the new red pickup truck, all of it. It's like it is Smokey the Bandit or the Dukes of Hazzard. You know, it's like they're living the dream. And, you know, the larger story that they're involved in is, of course, these health companies that are manufacturing these pills are profiting from this. They know that there's no conceivable way that the amount of pills that they're manufacturing relate to the actual demand for legitimate pain prescriptions. That, you know, so there's a company called Cardinal Health Insurance that that supplies essentially the Southeast, and they're banned by the DEA. Finally, so in Mexico, when they want to run drugs, you know, they have to build tunnels and submarines, and I've written about that over the years, the Mexican drug wars. And in the United States, these were basically the Mexican cartels, but they were Fortune 500 companies. And they didn't have to do anything. They just had to manufacture the pills, and then the doctors would benefit from all these different incentive schemes they have for writing prescriptions and just the money they get from churning people through their office. I mean, when Doug Dodd got his own pain prescription by faking a back injury and twisting his back for the MRI, his meeting with the doctor took 30 seconds.
Right. And probably cost a couple $100, and it was perfectly fine from his perspective because that's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, I mean, you know, his legitimate doctor, he went to see his actual doctor to try to, with this MRI report, and his legitimate doctor said, no, I'm not giving you that. That stuff's dangerous. You do not want to start messing with oxycodone. So he just went to what they call pill mills. He just went to a joint that was called like Pain Is Us or Pain Are Us or something like that. And it's just a doctor sitting there all day, this desiccated doctor just writing 400 pain prescriptions a day and making, you know, $600,000 a year doing it.
And the amazing thing about that Cardinal Health is that at one point you write the DEA realized like they are just overproducing. There's just no way.
Right.
They don't know that they are producing more than could be possibly consumed legally.
Right, so they put everyone in jail, right? They go to the source and they solve the problem. Isn't that what happened, Sam?
Right, almost. Almost. They basically just said, hey, you should be paying a little bit more of a tax, essentially.
Right, right, exactly. And so for a couple of weeks, there's a slowdown in business.
They suspended the production, which the guys felt on the street, apparently, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, on the street, no, they felt it. The street in this case is CVS.
Right. They go into CVS.
That's your street
corner. Explain
that
to people. Explain that to people because that's sort of
the place. If you want to score heroin, you know, you probably have to go to some questionable neighborhood or deal with some questionable people. If you want to get like a industrial sized amounts of pot or cocaine or meth, you know, watch Breaking Bad. Like you wind up having to deal with people who are criminals. In the case of prescription pain medications, which are just as dangerous, if not more so, and just as addictive, if not more so, you need to go to the CVS or the Walgreen. And you need to, you know, tell that nice Nigerian young man with the pharmacist tag on his lapel, here's my prescription. It's crazy because, I mean, it literally is heroin, you know, and so these kids were you know, caught up in a kind of cultural phenomena where they were, you know, the criminals. But the whole scenario, of course, was just aimed towards that.
Right. And they go there. There's a dearth for a while. And the company just pays what? They pay $34 million, which sounds like a lot. But it's probably a drop in the bucket over the course of 5 years of pumping this stuff out.
I don't think it will be a drop in the bucket, Sam. I think it would be a lot less than that. You know, I mean, $34 million. I mean, this is a multi-billion dollar industry. You know, the kids, these 18-year-olds, were making millions of bucks.
Right.
So you tell me what the system was yielding. And, you know, the solution, like not to be like Mr., you know, hold that, you know, hold the light up and judge everybody. I mean, but the answer to this is like so transparently obvious. It just involves some simple things, like, for example, having a register, you know, informing doctors of the risk, making sure that doctors are monitored to see if they're not writing too many scripts. Just like simple, basic stuff, you know, that the rest of the country was doing. The irony about it all is that the more regulatory schemes were effective, the higher the price on the street for the illegal Oxy and Roxy. So these kids started shipping it to Tennessee, and then this one guy says, hey, man, you should see how much this costs in Alaska.
Right.
So then they start shipping to Alaska, and then South Carolina, and then New York. So, you know, they were becoming Scarfaces. And as you say, the dynamic was one of the kids, Doug Dodd, sort of came from a family of hardened drug dealers. So he was, you know, acutely aware of the risks they were taking. The other kid came from more of the other sort of ringleader kid, the little general, came from more of a middle-class family. So he just was more brazen. You know, he was the kind of kid who bought an assault rifle. I mean, it's not funny, but he bought an assault rifle with a laser, and he used to sit outside on the deck of his, you know, high-end luxury loft in Tampa Bay and at nighttime and getting wasted and point the laser at the foreheads of people walking along the street, you know, for fun. So, well, yeah, it's you know, there's no
what
end
does
to
that
American
guy
dream.
Say? What does that guy say now? I mean, what is that guy now that he's in prison? Like, is he like,
you want me to read an email from him today? I could probably do that for you, right?
Sure.
Now.
But,
I mean, this is going in the story and we're doing the fact check. As you can imagine, Rolling Stone is being very careful about its fact checks this week.
Yes, indeed.
So, I mean, if people have followed that at all, it's, you know, the whole Virginia story has been a real tough one for the magazine. It's my experience just on that note, if anyone's following it, is that they've always been very thorough.
You know, it's interesting. There was two things that occurred to me as I'm reading your piece is that they, one, it's about how they sort of faked their pain and their problems with the MRI. And I'm talking to a guy today that we're pre-recording for the next week when we're on vacation about a guy who talks about the politics of pain. And then the other thing that occurs to me is that we've had both, I think, Carl Hart and Johan Hari on this program who have a different theory about, I think, sort of how one controls drugs and a different theory about the addictive qualities of these drugs on some level. And,
yeah,
you know, the idea that when it was readily accessible, you had far more abuse of these type of drugs. Now, it's also hard to measure because these guys are shipping them outside of the state, right? And so you can't really get a per capita notion. But that the abuse of these drugs is a function less of sort of controls and more of sort of the state of individuals.
I've never been on them, but I've heard that they are. I had a friend just had some surgery, and coming off them apparently is no easy ride.
I mean, that's also what I have heard on some level too. But I guess the question is, do you have the social context in which to be able to do that? Right. I mean, one guy was able to do it because he was just sort of acutely aware. One guy, the story, the Dodd guy, was acutely aware of, like, I have to, oddly enough, because he came from a family of people who had drug problems and had, I guess, gone to jail.
Yeah.
He was sort of more conscious of the costs of this.
The risks. Yeah. You know, I think that it's you know, if you're, you know, what you're talking about kind of, I think, on some level is, you know, the moral imagination. Like, so these things are legal and they're illegal. That's sort of a dissonant thing, right?
Right.
They're acceptable and they're unacceptable. And how do you draw lines? and the kids, I think, just were, especially like, you know, the young guys that were doing this were oblivious to those lines. I mean, they were aware they were breaking the law. I mean, you know, they were so dopey, like they didn't, like when you say the word interstate to somebody, you know, I think most people would understand that means federal.
Right.
But these kids were like, hey, we can do this interstate, no problem, without thinking, well, that might have consequences, you know? So, you know, I think that a lot of it is to do with technology and medicine being ahead of where we are kind of culturally.
Right. All right, we'll read that story because I'm that email from the little
general. Yeah, I just was pulling it up. I mean, you know, he rambles. He's like, hey, man, yeah, I did that. here we go. He's saying, yes, I was crazy, and I used to point the laser off my balcony at everything, and yes, sometimes too, but it was never loaded. I was crazy, but not stupid. There you go. That's a fairly representative.
He says from while serving 16 years, I guess, in prison.
Yeah, 15. Yeah. I mean, you know, definitely. He got the short end of the stick. And the reason he got the big time, apart from the fact that he was the ringleader, was that he didn't go first. He got ratted out by one of his colleagues. So, I mean, just as a piece of advice for any of your listeners out there who are involved in major criminal conspiracies, you know, be sure to be the one that goes to the law enforcement first.
Right. At the end, you all end up in the same place. Is that the idea?
No, the idea is if you cooperate first, you will not go to prison.
Oh, at all? But didn't all these guys go?
No, not the guy who's ratted them out. He's a car salesman in Tennessee.
And the other guy is also out of prison now, too.
Yeah,
right?
He did his spin. He did five.
Wow.
But the guy who went first, the guy who snitched, who got caught with some pot, and then basically the DEA came in and said, we're going to make it federal, and his lawyer said, make a deal, he's out and about.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, it's there's a lot of politics to law enforcement issues. In fact, I don't know how much time you got, Sam, but I do want to talk about that FBI thing.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I was looking into that. I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, so here I wrote a story a bunch of years ago for Rolling Stone about all these stories that you see on the front page of the New York Times, to return to the New York Times, about these terror plots that are these dastardly plots to blow up JFK or to, you know, attack a mall or something like
that. There were guys in Florida who were going to take over the U.S. government, but they just needed boots and I think it was like boots and uniforms.
Yeah, so all of these cases, and I think I can say all of these cases, and I wrote this story in like 2009, and there's been probably another 50 cases since, are plots concocted by the FBI. Basically, the FBI catches someone of Muslim descent or Muslim belief, you know, preferably of Arabic descent or, you know, some sort of speaks the lingo, and they're dealing drugs, prostitution, whatever it is, and they, if you speak, you know, Arabic, or if you have access to a mosque, the FBI swoops in and turns you into a cooperating informant, and they send you into this mosque armed with the limitless resources of the FBI and a plot to do something stupid like, you know, shoot down planes or blow up buildings, and then you just like troll around and try to find someone at that mosque who will agree with you. And the FBI, of course, is monitoring all this with their cameras and their wires and their cell phone monitoring systems. And then they sort of nurse this plot, these plots along. And then right at the last minute, typically, they come in, swoop in, and stop the plot that they themselves invented, and then hold a press conference and say, look at what we stopped.
There was just a guy who was released from prison. We talked about this. Maybe it was about a month ago, who was supposedly an eco-terrorist who this FBI informant, I mean, really, it's basically they're functioning as an FBI agent, had got involved in a romantic relationship with this guy and basically just kept pushing him and pushing him and pushing him till he finally said, OK, I'll do it. And that's when they came in and arrested him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's been released because they basically ultimately decided years later that it was entrapment.
Yeah, well, so it's not, you know what they call it? I mean, the problem, so they call it a reverse sting. That's the law enforcement term for it. And the idea is essentially that law enforcement creates a criminal conspiracy and then goes finds people who participate or, you know, targets someone specifically and then gets them to agree to do something illegal. And then pretends as if that was their idea.
Right.
And then the thing about the defense of entrapment is that in order to say you've been entrapped, you have to show that you didn't have prior disposition a previous disposition to commit that kind of crime. So the first thing they get you recording, the first thing that they get these informants to do is record you saying things like, you know, I hate the United States, or, you know, invading, saying incendiary things, George Bush should die, or, you know, the big corporations are poison to our environment. Things that would be totally
benign,
the jury.
Right. Benign outside of the context that later they get you to agree to something.
Yeah, all they're trying to do, and they specifically purpose these informants to get you to say things that deny you the defense of entrapment.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so, but here's one of the point I wanted to make about this report this week that I mentioned to you. So there's a report this week saying that the FBI is not effectively countering the threat of terrorism. To which I say, no kidding. You know, are you kidding me? I once was in, for the Rolling Stone article, I was sitting in this Joint Terrorism Task Force, like, fortress in Chicago that they built, probably spent $500 million on it, you know, behind seven layers of wire and all that stuff. And I'm in a boardroom, and I'm interviewing these senior guys about the nature of the terrorist threat in the United States. And one of these guys says to me, well, look, there's 400,000 Muslims in Chicago alone. That means if there's 1% of them are terrorists, there's 40,000 terrorists in Chicago.
Right.
And I say, you mean 4,000 or 40,000? And the guy says, I guess I mean 4,000. And I put that in the article, and the law enforcement, I got denounced by the head of the FBI. I got, you know, all this heat. They don't want to talk to Rolling Stone anymore, apparently. Because I quoted someone who didn't have any appreciation of the first thing that he was trying to confront. And so if you create these shadows and these ghosts, as the FBI has done for, you know, a decade or more now, where do you think you're going to wind up? The thing I was thinking about this morning as I was looking forward to coming onto your wonderful show was this thought. Okay, the United States invades Iraq. It's a disaster. United States government invades Afghanistan. It's a disaster. Now, what if I suggest that the United States' version of the war on terror domestically is equally disastrous? Why wouldn't it be?
I mean, I've
never heard that said, but I think that's right.
Well, I think, listen, you know, there's a quality to all of this. It's about sort of like the self-licking ice cream cone. The idea being also that this is there's just a lot of business being made for themselves on some level. And
well, you got to go to these Homeland Security trade shows, man. You got to see it. It's like incredible. You know, the Javits Center in New York City, they'll have like 10,000 exhibitors selling every kind of device and little macho nonsensical thing, you know, from listening things to guns and stuff. I mean, it's so childish, you know. I mean, I don't know. I don't mean to say that this is easy, and I don't think that law enforcement's got an easy job of it. And I respect a lot of the people that work in that field who have a tough, tough, tough time of it. But the idea that you create your own little ghosts and that your own little plots and that's going to solve something, I mean, just apply it to your own life, you know?
Well, you know what's also shocking about this is that, you know, I read when you told me you want to talk about this report, right? I looked up again. We're back at the Times, but I look up the Times piece.
Yeah, yeah.
Report credits FBI with progress since 9/11, but says more is needed. And then it's like you go down into the story, and the report said to improve its intelligence gathering and analysis, the FBI needed to have more informants. The panel examined the details of five FBI counterterrorism investigations. In none of those cases did a confidential source provide actionable intelligence to prevent or respond to a terrorist operation. But it did not put the blame on the FBI. It said that budget cuts had severely hindered the FBI.
It just makes you want to cry, right? It's like the solution is that, you know, more money.
It really is stunning. And so they haven't really done anything.
You meet these guys, right? And it's, you know, they're your neighbors and stuff. I mean, but the lots and lots, and I don't mean a couple. I mean thousands upon thousands of these folks are just like glinty-eyed true believers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they when they foil a plot, like that they themselves have created. They really feel in their heart of hearts that they've done something profoundly important for the security of the country.
Well, you'd have to, right? I mean, you have to.
I guess. But, you know, you've got one political party who thinks that the war in Iraq was won. So, I mean, the idea of coming at this issue critically just seems so remote.
I think it's going to take so long. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that we spoke to Rick Perlstein about his book some time ago, and one of the things that just sort of really resonated to me about that book was, and I can't remember the exact year, if it was 75, in 1975 or 74, there were 85 terrorist attacks in this country.
Right.
In 75, 20 some odd people died at LaGuardia at the baggage check from a bomb.
Right.
The notion of the way the country responded to those type of things then versus now is stunning.
It really is.
If somebody went into if there was even like if they found a bomb, never mind even if it went off, even if it was like something that could actually not even explode, even if it was something that would just like blow up a toilet bowl in LaGuardia now, the whole city would be on lockdown.
The country.
Lincoln, Nebraska airport, you'd be in lockdown.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's a strange phenomenon. You know, I saw 9/11. I don't take that lightly. You know, I saw it out my window. I lived in Brooklyn Heights at the time, and I saw both those. I saw the second plane fly in. I saw the those buildings collapse. I lived through that time. I know exactly. And to this minute, I have a terrible sense of that tragedy, a physical. It's with me as a physical presence. But I feel like the response has been so misguided and scattered and you know, I mean, I was on I think it was the very first flight out of New York. I went to Beirut to interview the spiritual leader of Hezbollah to ask about these suicide bombers. And this was, you know, like September 22nd or something. And you should have seen JFK then. It was a
right.
ghost. I mean, it was like there was one flight on British Airways and I was on it and the flight was empty. So... I continue to feel the consequences of that, but you know, in those early weeks, just the way that the conflation of the Taliban and Al Qaeda just seemed to me so indicative of like what was coming. And I remember a few things were said at that time that I think have really been profoundly important for the country. One of them was Donald Rumsfeld said, if you can't solve a problem, enlarge it. And just walk around with that thought for a while. So, you know, Al-Qaeda wasn't sufficiently big as a problem. So really what's happened is it's become Islam.
Right.
Over time. Another one that I really think has had a huge impact is the personal cowardice of Dick Cheney. I think that he was scared, very, very scared that day. And in the days that followed the undisclosed location, Dick Cheney. And I think that fear infected the government. I think that George Bush took his marching orders from him, and we basically entered the age of terror. That, in other words, that bin Laden was correct.
I also think that there was a tremendous amount of money, of pent-up demand, you know,
right.
And that just
shrinking military budgets at the time and that kind of thing.
And just stepped right in and just said, this is an opportunity. I think there was a whole apparatus, and I think you, Dick Cheney very well may have been personally scared, but I think it also was just an extension of his whole worldview.
You know, I reported a story that I never actually wrote, and you know, I can't even tell you why. I think it was just mostly because I was writing at GQ at the time, and there was a new editor, and it was a hard piece to get your head around, but it fascinated me at the time, this whole idea of the continuity of government plans, and they call it COGS, and essentially it's like the doomsday, it's the Doctor Strangelove scenario,
right?
And they actively plan for this stuff, right? And they have for many, you know, for decades, generations. But what was really interesting about it was there were all these, like, you know, post 9/11 glinty-eyed, you know, when the Muslims come over the hill, we'll get them this way and that, you know, all we have to do is spy and do all these things that we've discussed today. But the people who are really expert at it, to speak to what you said about Rick Perlstein, they're like, that's not really the threat. The threat really is like, okay, a meteor. You know, the threat really is you know, civil unrest, eco-terrorists.
Right. Right, of course.
You know, it's like the real threat is kind of like what you'd expect it to be. And so, but the country's got so kind of removed from what's going on, it's become neurotic, right? What's the definition of neuroses? It's like doing something despite the fact that you know it's bad for you.
Well, but that I think, you know, that's my point, is I think that there's definitely a part of our the establishment in this country that saw this as a massive opportunity. It may come from their paranoia, but this was, look, you know, this was.
I mean, I agree with that, but I think that's a, I mean, to me, that the cultural thing creates the business opportunity, and I'm not, but I think that you can't have one
without
the
other. Same thing happened 25 years ago, or when, you know, you had 20 people die in a bombing in LaGuardia. I think it's just maybe it was easier for the American public to sort of swallow this external threat, right, as opposed to, you know, Timothy McVeigh blowing up.
Well, I mean, and as a non-American, you know, I don't want to say un-American. I'm Canadian and Australian in my nationality, and as a non-American, which I think informs all my writing and all my reporting, I'm always astounded by the lack of self-reflection in the media. You know, like the idea that, you know, look, Bradley Cooper is producing Arms and the Dudes, and I'm sure he's a really good guy. But American Sniper as a movie was just astonishing to me, because it was essentially asked you to sympathize with someone who went to a distant country that had done really nothing to deserve this particular fate, kill a couple hundred people, and then feel sorry for him. Like, what's the math on that? You know, it continues to astound me that the sense of victimization that comes with this. And I, you know, to me, like I probably hope the NSA is getting this all down. It's all in the service of a couple more Facebook likes.
That's right. So I hope the folks at the NSA will please like. I think they also actually have an ability just immediately put you into the stratosphere of likes. Like,
right,
you
hey,
could
I
wake up
like
tomorrow and the NSA could have given you like maybe 500,000 likes. They just have a button to do that.
Right.
Gee, have a great time out in California. We will talk when you get back. And when Bradley Cooper quits the movie, you have my number.
Yeah, and you let me know when Myla, your daughter, gets her device privileges back, because my girls will be eager to hear from her.
Yes, that will be maybe they'll probably get a text out in California.
All right, thanks, Sam.
All right, Guy Lawson. And folks, oh, I should remind you that Guy's Twitter handle. Do we have Guy's Twitter handle?
No, we do his Facebook.
Oh, his Facebook. He wants the likes on the Facebook. All right, we'll put his.
Right. Yeah, it's on the Facebook.
He does
on our
Guy Lawson too.
Guy Lawson,
I don't think, though, we went through this at one point.
Yeah,
he doesn't tweet,
Facebook.
And
Facebook.
He wants people to like his Facebook, so that's the link you find on
this
the homepage.
This is like, you know, Guy is, you know, he's old school, and sees this Facebook thing, and he's just like, how do I get, he posts interesting stuff on his Facebook feed, too, I got to say.
Yeah.
And I'm not a big Facebook user, but I get like a. Some type of digest or something.
He's really into goji berries. He's really into different weight loss stuff. It's fascinating. It's kind of surprising.
Diabetes.
Yeah. It's all like, sign up now.
I should also say
sign up now. Sort of surprising. Myla
has been grounded from her iPod.
Oh, yeah.
And she would text Guy's daughters. And they would. That's how they would stay in touch. And Myla's been grounded, and the grounding came swift and fast. And so I had to be the conduit, because Myla was like, just please tell Lucy and Anna that the reason why, if they've texted me, I can't respond is because of you. And I was like, fine.
Did you say part of grounding is daddy doesn't relay messages?
That's right. Daddy actually relays opposite messages. So I'm going to tell Guy to tell Lucy and Anna that Myla no longer wants to talk to them. No, I would not do
grounding
that.
Grounding hardball.
I would not do that. That's
ruin your daughter's childhood friendships.
Right, exactly.
You didn't just lose your tech privileges. You just lost
That's right.
Social
your social
life.
Status. All right, we're going to take a quick break and head into the funner half of the program. We got a lot of good sound, and we'll talk about that 46. There were 46, I think, Democratic senators.
I think it was every single Democrat.
Each senator who was on the record.
Each senator.
Who was present.
Who was present, right.
Voted and was now on the record as voting to expand Social Security benefits. So this is a very positive, you know, this is not going to happen overnight. But, you know, we could be still 3, 4, 5 years away. Maybe less, though, you know, where this could be, we could get down that road and be much trickier, I think. You know, down the road for any Democrat to basically not be on board with this. And never mind cuts, right? I mean, how do you justify cuts after you've voted to expand Social Security? So, all right, we're going to take a quick break. Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at Majority FM. You can, if you're not ready to become a member, head over to our Indiegogo campaign at themajorityreport.com. We got some great perks. We're going to add some, I think, in the coming days. But check out the ones that we got now. You know what I'm surprised about that I thought would do much better? What? Was the Majority Report, the shopping bags.
There are two of the people in the room that did not share your same level of optimism about that particular offering.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure I understand why that's the case.
Look,
how many bags are we offering on that?
I think what? 7,500?
No, I'm saying per perk. Oh, is it just one or is it two?
I thought it was just one.
You know what? We're upping it to two. I'm going to give
that'll bring them.
Yeah.
You think?
You want more canvas bags?
Not canvas.
I know.
That's the point. They're not canvas.
No, they're really good bags. They're bags that you can actually like shop in.
They've been recycled from plastic bottles. Well, that's what I use when I go to the
like
supermarket.
Really
good bags. They're recycled.
I'm just surprised by it. It's only 15.
You actually sounded like a hybrid of Scott Brown and an old Jewish lady.
It's only 15 out of 100 are claimed. And frankly, I'm sort of surprised by that. I'm sort of surprised.
What can you do?
They're really get your bags, folks.
Well,
make Sam happy.
No.
That's the only thing that surprised me.
And it is actually a great way to promote the show.
Well, that's the thing is that you go to the supermarket at least once a week, and you've got your Majority Report bag. Everybody sees you walking around with it. I don't know. I guess one more example of how I'm not good at business.
When I go grocery shopping, I usually just carry the bags that they hand me.
Well, that's
because you don't care about
that's right. You don't care
about the environment. Not at all. In fact, I specifically asked for paper bags.
Plastic would be worse than paper, buddy.
I mean, plastic. That's what I meant to say. Plastic bags.
All right, we're going to take a break. Head into the fun half of the program.
My bad.
Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Number 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number to be a part of the program. You want to IM me? You can IM me through the app at majorityapp.com. Pick up the app. One or two of my IMs are not working, some of the legacy ones. So you got to get it through the app today, folks. All right, we'll be right back after this.